Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate.
Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm your host this week, Amanda Bullock. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. We have a great event for you to close out our celebration of National Poetry Month, featuring poet and essayist Amy Nezuko Matatzel at the final event of the 2023-24 season of Portland Arts and Lectures. Nezuko Matatzel is an accomplished poet. Literally every one of her four published poetry collections is prize-winning, and she's the first ever poetry editor of Sierra Magazine, the storytelling arm of the Sierra Club. In 2020, she turned to prose with a book of essays, World of Wonders, in praise of fireflies, whale sharks, and other astonishments, which combines personal memoir with reflections on the natural world. World of Wonders was a finalist for the Kirkus Prize in Nonfiction and was named Barnes & Noble's Book of the Year. It's one of the books that will change the way that you see the world around you, the animals, the plants, and the human animals. And who can argue against approaching our own lives and the lives of others with a little more wonder? The San Francisco Chronicle wrote, "The nature writing we have been exposed to has been overwhelmingly male and white, which is just one reason that Amy Nezuko Matatzel's latest essay collection is a breath of fresh air. What makes her work shine is its joyful embrace of difference, revealing that true beauty resides only in diversity." For me, the word that comes most to mind if you read Amy's work or follow her on Instagram or encounter her in any way is joy. Whether she's roller skating, sometimes with her chihuahua, in Oxford, Mississippi, where she's a professor of English and creative writing, or, of course, sharing her vibrant poetry and prose, I know that our worlds are more wonderful thanks to her words and mind. Here's Amy Nezuko Matatzel.
Nobody expects a toad to survive a tarantula attack. But because the toad, the pebble toad in particular, can do something so wholly unexpected, it survives. And in the process, it plops down and lands in an entirely new space. Let's go ahead and cue up the video here.
On a mountain plateau, a mile above the jungles of South America, lives another daredevil. The pebble toad is only a few centimeters long. This little toad can't hop, which could be a problem when it comes face to face with its arch enemy, the tarantula.
Just so cute.
Not held back by its shortcomings, this tiny toad tenses its muscles and turns itself into a rubber ball.
Dramatic, I love it.
Being so small and weighing so little means bouncing doesn't hurt at all. Not being able to hop doesn't stop him getting down, but it would make life a whole lot easier on the way back up.
Okay. whoever scored the soundtrack for that pebble toad needs, that's who needs the applause there. What people may not anticipate or understand for your life path might very well be your superpower. And the most important takeaway from this video, notice the toad didn't just fall into a puddle and stay there. Where it was most comfortable, where there was shelter and water nearby. No, no, the pebble toad hoisted herself out of there and forged her own path, climbing back up, finding a new way up the mountain and into the sunshine. All right, I just want you to know, do you know that you are in the presence of Ohio football royalty here? I just want you to be aware of that little fact here, okay? I went to a high school that was kind of the Ohio version of Friday Night Lights of Texas, but I wasn't a cheerleader. I was Western Ohio's first ever female football mascot. Thank you. No, please don't clap for that. That's the dorkiest thing ever. Please don't clap. When I came home one day and told my parents what I just signed up for, to say they were not pleased would be like saying Portland just gets a little bit of rain every once in a while. I know they wanted me to spend time, like more time doing homework, more time studying, anything but watching football games, dressed as a battling beaver for Beaver Creek High. Yes, you heard that right. I was a battling beaver. That was the name of our mascot. And I know one of my friends from high school is actually here with me. So she could at least vouch for that. I'm not making this up. And I remember, you know, hearing my parents arguing when I was in my room over my decision that I made. And I can remember hearing my mom yelling, "We did not come to this country so our daughter could be Mickey Mouse," you know? My immigrant parents wanted me to be that classic, that doctor so bad. And I entered Ohio State as a chemistry major. I'm laughing now. No offense to the people who were chemistry majors, but that was just not, I should have known that was not my path. A little bit of a red flag for me is that I somehow made it through high school and much of college without ever lighting a Bunsen burner. That should have been a red flag that I was not going to finish in chemistry. I was terrified of the Bunsen burner. Anyway, I learned early on, like, about this picture, about from 4 to 5 years old, at the various doctor parties growing up, that if a grown-up asked me what I wanted to be, I learned that if I said, a doctor, just like mommy, the whole room would give me a round of applause and more dessert. So I just kept, and they would also let me stay up late. So I just kept saying I wanted to be a doctor. But very much unbeknownst to them, my parents were leading me towards a path of being a lifelong learner, curious about the natural world, because they both had modeled being open to wonder. And no matter what, they always, always had time, no matter how many long hours they worked at the hospital, they always had time to take my sister and I to the library. My father and mother's love language to each other, and for our whole family really, was the way they worked so beautifully together in their garden, which is now in Florida. This one is Chicago, but that's the first garden I ever experienced. Now they're retired in Florida, and my dad can be genuinely excited about the shape or the color of the inside of a dragon fruit or a star fruit or any of the 5 different varieties of mangoes in their yard. But he could also be mocked at work or in a drive-through for his deep and beautiful Indian accent. Even in spite of all this kind of making fun of his accent, he would always find a way to show us that something like finding constellations in suburban Arizona or how to call cardinals to your yard with a whistle and some water. And now I can do it without a whistle. And it's that by far is the nerdiest party trick in the world for me. Fast forward to my junior year in college, where the struggle was real. I mean, I was on the struggle bus when I hit the class called organic chemistry. I remember fumbling over a lab in the study lounge, but I was procrastinating and someone had left a piece of paper on a table nearby. It looked like a paragraph, and I learned later what it was. But it was the title of it was something called Mint Snowball. Folks, there's a quote from Emily Dickinson, and I'm going to butcher it. But it's something like, if I read a book and I feel so cold no fire could ever warm me, I know that that is poetry. If I feel like the top of my head were taken off, I know that that is poetry. That's what it felt like to read this piece of paper. I just was so floored by it. Here's a little snippet of it. This is just a little snip. So I could not get over this description of a frozen, icy dessert and someone's grandpa who made it. I tacked it up on our dorm bulletin board and I said, like, whose handout is this? Please see Amy in room 324. A few hours later, there was a hockey player in my dorm who knocked on my door and was like, hi, that's my homework. And by the way, it's called a poem. Like, I could not believe it, folks. I went to a nice high school. I took two different AP English and Literature classes. I didn't know how it was possible. I never read a poem by a single living poet until that day. I said, I have to see, what class is this? I can't believe this is a whole class. What is this? He was like, yeah, it's called Poetry Writing 101. And I was like, I need to go with you. When is the class being held? And da, da, da. He's like, okay, can you just walk with me, you know, a little bit behind me when we go? Because you're a little too excited for this early in the morning, you know. So I did. And when I showed up to class, I asked the professor, hi, you don't know me. I'm a chemistry major. I promise I won't make a disturbance. I just want to see what this class is. And folks, I could not believe there was a class where people read poetry. And not only that, you were asked to write some of your own. And not only that, the class and the professor would help you learn to write poetry as well. This was the tumbling pebble toad phase for me. Remember our dear little friend somersaulting backwards down the mountain? That was me. Okay, I just wanted to set the scene. 48 hours after that class, I dropped pre-med. I dropped honors chemistry. I dropped out of the pre-med sorority that I was in. But I enrolled as an English major with zero idea or plans what I would do when I graduated. I just knew if I didn't take as many literature and poetry writing classes as I could, I would suffocate. I had gotten decent grades all my life. I mean, hello, honors program. But I was kind of a zombie when it came to doing the work. And I liked school, but I just had never felt excited to learn as I did once I switched my major to English. And it wasn't like it was easy peasy for me. I was woefully behind on my reading, especially of contemporary writers. Even though I read a ton, it wasn't literature. It was science and nature books. So what I mentioned before to some of the high schoolers I met today, you know, now young adult literature is amazing and vibrant and so interesting. But back then, at the time, it was Mary lost a cake. Mary went to a bakery. She still could not find the right cake. Let's have Mary walk down the street and see if it was hidden in another bakery. There's a cake for Mary. I just was thinking, like, Mary is a moron. Like, what is going on? So where the action was in science and nature books for me. I love people who studied volcanoes and books and rocks and the hunt for the giant squid. So yeah, I had a lot of catching up to do when it came to reading literature, especially by living writers. So the next week was spring break. Again, I'm still setting that scene for the tumbling pebble toad phase. Next week that day, that time was spring break. And those in the audience, there's a special test you take as a junior in college if you're pre-med. Does anyone know what it's called? MCATs, yes, the MCATs. So I was signed up to take it, had studied for it. I skipped the MCATs, and I got my roommate to come with me to a movie where we basically cried through the whole movie because I was thinking I had made a terrible, terrible mistake. So for spring break, I got home, and I was mortified to see my parents had cooked this giant meal. They were like, let's celebrate our future doctor, all this stuff. You've been studying so hard. We want to hear all about the MCATs. We want to, you know, like, you just rest now. Inside, I was freaking out. So I couldn't take it. After dinner, I set them down in the living room. I told them not only did I not take the MCATs, but that I was never, ever going to take it. I was not going to take the MCATs, the LSATs. It was more like the prospects for my future was like SPLAT. Get it? Split? Yeah. I know, that's so bad. I know. I just... But folks, my mother got up and didn't speak to me for the rest of that day, for that night. And my father started weeping. Now, I can laugh about it now, but I can remember at the time, actually to this day, I've seen my father cry exactly 3 times. Once in joy when he was walking me down the aisle. Second time when I presented him with his first grandchild, also in joy. And the third time was when I told him I wanted to be a poet, which was not joy. It was utter confusion and despair. And then again, I just, that night, I heard my parents arguing again in the kitchen, and I heard my mom say, and I remember this so vividly, "This is all your fault," talking to my dad. "You let her be Mickey Mouse, and now she wants, to be a poet," you know? She never got the name was Bucky. She kept calling me Mickey Mouse, so... But I'll never forget, before I went back to Ohio State after spring break, my father sat me down and he said, in his beautiful, beautiful accent, which I cannot do, but he said, like, "Amy, your mother and I are very worried about what you're doing with your life. And we have no idea what you are going to do with your future. But if you promise me one thing. If you want to be a Shakespeare," he said, "a Shakespeare," because that's the only poet he knew. "If you want to be a Shakespeare, promise me you will find something that makes you feel like a student for the rest of your life." And I get choked up a little bit about that, because in generations of Nezuko Matatils, nobody else was given a choice. Everyone was expected to be in the medical field or engineering. And my mother eventually came around. She started speaking to me again. But now, fast forward, now it is so embarrassing. They are my biggest, biggest fans. And they tell their neighbors in their little retirement village, anytime I publish something, it's, as my sons say, total cringe, you know. But I have to say, you know, the only poet my parents ever knew was Shakespeare. And I have to say, one small moment of satisfaction is the first time I ever appeared in a high school AP language textbook. And now I've actually lost count of the number of table of contents of various books where I share the table of contents with a certain Mr. Bill Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. Now, my parents also cultivated wonder for our whole family by showing me that it is never too late to learn from a variety of voices, especially voices of people who are different than you. Even with advanced science and medical degrees, they showed me there is always something to marvel over and stay curious about the planet for your whole life. Wonder is also vital because people of color and differently abled members and of our communities and members of the LGBTQ community's lives quite literally depend on it. So I ask you, what if sharing what we wondered about becomes contagious? And what if sharing our big and little astonishments also becomes contagious? What if it reminds us that we are all interconnected and that we need each other to help us grow in our understanding of each other? Because when you make wonder a practice, you feel less alone. And when we don't normalize seeing and reading about people of color, especially in the outdoors, We get constantly told we don't belong. We get told to go back to your country, even if we were born here. We need to normalize teaching and studying narratives and perspectives from a range of backgrounds because lives are literally at stake. Cops are called, guns are drawn, a whole race will be blamed when there is a national crisis. For example, the Arab and Desi community after 9/11. Example, Asian Americans getting their face slashed on the subway or getting slaughtered on the job in Atlanta when we had people in the government who blame an entire pandemic on Asians. I wrote a good portion of World of Wonder right after the 2016 election, and I'm not gonna lie, there were many, many difficult days in writing about wonder and belonging when some of our government's leaders encouraged fear of brown people, and when some of our they fostered a distrust for knowledge and science. But on my darkest days of writing, when I thought of my loved ones, when I thought of my friends and students, it was easy to insist on and remember how good it feels to express astonishment and to be curious about others. I try not to be prescriptive in this book. In the South, they have a saying, you catch more flies with honey. But my hope is that readers are guided towards a possibility of tenderness and wonderment towards other living things. I wrote this book with love in mind, and it was very, very important for me to do two things, to start and end this book in Mississippi, and to start and end this book with love. I hope that my book of short nature essays helps the reader picture people of color in the outdoors, and I know some of the young ones in the audience might be like, what's the big deal, what's the big deal? I know you grew up with Dora the Explorer, or there's a cute little cartoon veterinarian who's African-American. Who is that? Doc McStuffins, yes. If you don't know Doc McStuffins, you have to look her up. She's so adorable. I literally did not see anybody with even dark hair growing up in the 70s. I saw one person. Some of you will know this. Her name was Linda Carter. And she wore a leotard. That was the only time I saw black curly hair on TV. That's Wonder Woman, for those of you who don't know, my original Wonder Woman. I hope people can see possibilities for them that perhaps don't align with their parents' hopes and dreams. I hope for people's imaginations to grow wider after getting to know these plants a little and animals a little bit better. So what if we start small? As in, as small as a firefly. What if we wrote about what we were curious about in a journal that no one else sees but you? What if we allowed ourselves to admit we don't have all the answers, that we depend on someone else's experience and knowledge? It's a humbling and a vulnerability of ourselves. This is overwhelming. So again, how about we start small? Ask yourself, what do you love? What do you fear? What do you wonder about? And again, you don't have to share this with anybody. It's great if you do, but you can just write this in a journal. Can you name 5 things on this planet that you're curious about? What if we shared these with each other and created fellowship and community in our homes and our classrooms? My biggest hope is that when reading about a plant or an animal that you maybe previously did not know, that we might feel some tenderness towards creatures and plants and people that we've never seen before or had direct experience with. So for example, if you knew fish names and knew the tender way a certain fish took care of its tiny eggs in their very own mouths, like the jawfish, or knew how certain birds use the moon and stars to figure out how to fly home, which is the indigo buntings, or knew how a woman pulled up a blanket to their son's chin on a cold night in the Middle East, I would imagine it would be harder. How could you want to make a violence on them? And what is lost when you grow up not knowing the names for different varieties of anything? In this case, for all the different names and varieties of fireflies. I was sad to learn that here in Portland, there are no fireflies that live here. But if you are lucky enough to catch them in the summer, just about to firefly season in Mississippi, we're about 1 month away. But what happens when you grow up not being curious about insects at all. What happens when you don't have the firefly names like these on your tongue? And so I wanna just share with you just some of them, not all of them, some of my favorite firefly varieties. What happens when you don't know about these? How about the Shadow Ghost, the Sidewinders, the Florida Sprites, the Mr. Max, Little Grays, Murky Flash Trains, the Texas Tinies, the Single Snappies, that's my favorite, the Treetop Flashers, a July Comet, the Tropic Travelers, the Christmas Lights, a Slow Blue, a Tiny Lucy, the Mischievous Marsh Imps, the Sneaky Elves, and in a tie, well, I lied, a tie for my personal favorite, the Heebie-Jeebies and the Wiggle Dancers. I knew all of that because of my father, like, kind of gave me that language for naming the bugs that I saw all over the country. And scientists still don't know how or when or why fireflies decide to stay visually silent. Even entomologists can admit they don't have all the answers. Even though a field of tall grass can be teeming with fireflies, the space and time between flashes have grown longer over the years. My sons want to know the answer to these increasing silences too. It's been 7 years since we've been in Mississippi, and they were 6 and 9 when we first lived there, and they are noticing there's fewer and fewer fireflies just in the time that we've been there. I'm reminded of this quote by the genius cellist Yo-Yo Ma, who said, "Each day I move toward that which I do not understand. The result is a continuous accidental learning which constantly shapes my life." There is so much I don't know about the natural world, but I view that curiosity as a good thing, a place where I feel alive and my pulse quickens because I genuinely want to know the hows and whys of creatures and plants with whom I share this planet. I want to go back to being vulnerable and admit there is so much that we don't know and yet would still like to learn. Maybe start with what we loved as kids and see where that leads us. Because when wonder is a practice, you feel less alone. And I want to just say that one more time. When wonder is a practice, you feel less alone. I often get asked for writing advice, and I know not everybody here is writers. I also hate being too limited and prescriptive in that way. So I have just a few little things that I would call kind of maybe life advice. Just three things. Number one, floss. Floss your, and I don't mean that little dance. I mean like actually floss your teeth. Yeah. It just helps in so many varieties of communications, I promise. Number two, say thank you. Bonus points if you actually write out a thank you card for things. I tell you, and this is not a cut on my beloved students at the University of Mississippi, but I always do some sort of letter writing project with them. The more, there's an increasing number of students who have no idea what corner to put the stamp on an envelope anymore. So please, let's keep the Postal Service alive and write, practice snail mail, you know, give happy mail. Yeah. And lastly, be curious. Most of all, strive to be a student of something for the rest of your life. Don't strive for being a know-it-all. And if you are a know-it-all, stay home until there's, I always want to give, you know, hope that someone might change, you know. Stay home until you understand that people think you are insufferable. And see if that might move you to soften up a little bit. Be tender and open to curiosity about the world. And if you know a know-it-all, don't vote them into office. Right? You don't want someone who can't admit they might need advice once in a while. Let's share what nourishes us with each other. I promise that sharing is contagious in all the best ways. Stay open to the possibility that there is always something to learn and wonder about, because those sparks can light a path to remind ourselves, if we let ourselves be astonished by a whole range of voices, if you remember and relearn how to wonder, we set the groundwork for cultivating a more tender and just world. Let's go back to our pebble-toed friend. Simply put, folks, if you remember how to be curious about the world, about others, you will never feel bored or lonely on this planet. I promise you. So remember the little pebble-toed friend from the beginning? Try to be like a pebble toad. Even after a big tumble, after big uncertainty, it ends up back into the sunshine on top of a mountain. When the pebble toad decides to pursue a curiosity, when the pebble toad comes face to face with an obstacle or a terror even, and seems to have spectacularly, comically fallen so far away from what is expected of her, and maybe for all of you, this might mean a job shift, it might mean a life change, or a new skill or job to learn about, or move to another part of the country. But remember, after the pebble toad's tumble, she is rewarded with an unforeseen and oftentimes surprising new path. Here it is, folks. The world is full of wonders. All you have to do is to let yourself be astonished. Let yourself be curious about the planet and each other again. Thank you so, so much. Thank you, thank you. Thank you.
So you mentioned in your talk, and you talked to earlier today, about teachers that you've had.
Yes.
And there's some in your book, mostly good, some bad teachers.
I wouldn't even say bad, just maybe misguided a little bit.
Misguided, yeah. Memorable for not the best reasons.
Yeah.
You'll have to read the book to find out what we're talking about. And you're a teacher, too. Mm-hmm. And I bet you're a very good teacher.
Well, I have my days, both good and bad, as every human does, yeah.
What do you feel like is the relationship between your teaching and your creative work, and how do those things interact for you?
I love that question. You know, I mean, they go hand in hand for me. I mean, I love school. I basically have never left a campus. Once I kind of realized, oh, school could be fun, and there could be just constantly, you know, I'm a tenured professor, and I still feel like that little girl sitting on the floor of a library, you know, just getting lost in the stacks, you know. And I'm so grateful that has never, ever been extinguished, you know. I remember as a young girl, shout out to the librarians here, you know. I mean, them flicking the lights. Yes, shout out to librarians. I know. I just have such a fondness for them where, they never made fun of my questions, and I had lots of questions. I think I've read every narwhal book possible in the state of Arizona. They just kept, ordering more and more for me, and this is pre-internet times, so, I had to wait for, weeks sometimes to get a book, and I can remember sitting on the floor of libraries, and they'd flicker the lights and come on and say, Amy, it is time to make your final selection. You know, just that hunger for, there's just so much to read. And no, I have no tolerance for people who say that they are bored and or have nothing to write about. And I hope that enthusiasm, that contagiousness, carries on in my own classroom as well. I teach in the South, which is its own amazing and complicated thing. And I love, my favorite is when I get, a frat boy in and with his hat down saying, I hate nature. I'm just in this class because I needed to graduate. And I'm like, yes, that is my specialty, you know. And by semester's end, I have them crying, not because I'm mean, but because they're like just astonished at the, like, the books that we're reading and like, how could this be so beautiful? I want to go to I want to go to Yosemite now or whatever, you know, things like that. So it's just such a joy. I'm on sabbatical now, so I have a special fondness. I can't wait to go back to teaching this fall. But yeah, they're intertwined. So directly back to your question, I'm a better teacher when I'm writing and researching, and I'm a better writer or researcher when I have all cylinders blazing in the classroom, because I know I need to like present concepts to them to understand it, and it just informs my writing. So they go hand in hand for me. I don't see one or the other as like, ugh, I have too much time, or I wish I had more time writing, or I wish I had more time teaching. They're just hand in hand. Yeah.
That's great. It's like everything's a classroom.
Yeah, it kind of is.
So you mentioned your experience with Last Call at the library. And you mentioned in the book too, in the whale shark section, you said you'd been studying whale sharks for like over a year by the time you met them. Mm-hmm. How do you research? And has that, your new book is about food, bite by bite. Was that different than researching this book? Or can you talk a little bit about so much research into relatively short essays too?
Exactly, yeah. You know, I love that question about this question of research, which you don't really think of to be connected with a poet. So in World of Wonders, they're two very different. So I have a new book coming out at the end of this month. It's called Bite by Bite, and it's all on food. So they're illustrated essays, short essays, on like the origins of where do we get cinnamon? Why do I love gyro sandwiches so much? You know, and it's not a highfalutin, you know, sometimes you get food books that are like, look at me and all of my travels around the world, and look at my spice cabinets that have things you've never heard of and will never be able to find. This is not it. I mean, there is no pretension, and there is, I just love thinking about, you know, how did we get apples here? And, you know, all the nerdy kind of folklore things about the origins of butter and the not so pretty things, like how did we get sugar? So that research is very different. That's what I would call traditional research, because I didn't know the answers to these questions. And I was reading for the last 5 years. And, you know, I've been writing about food for 20 years and reading, just that's my... That's my jam, is just I read a lot. And my kind of dirty secret is that I actually read more nonfiction than I ever do, you know, novels or plays, you know, and things like that. So that was definitely taking meticulous notes, things like that. World of Wonders, if you notice, it doesn't have, you know, it doesn't have an index or a bibliography, because I wish I had a better answer, but I'm just a big nerd. And I had to fact check this. We fact checked this to make sure that it's fine. I got measurements correct. But I just knew this stuff already, because I've been reading about these animals and plants since I was a little girl, or I had seen these things since I was a little girl. So there wasn't really much that I was I actually didn't do research, except if I just wanted to check the measurements of something, you know. So that was a very different process. This is just a showcase of my nerdy self, and my food book has what we consider traditional research. Yeah.
We actually have a question about food.
Okay.
What's your favorite food memory with your family besides when your father was weeping about your career choice?
I know. No, that is definitely not a happy memory at all. It was terrible. The dinner that they made for me was incredible, but I could not enjoy it because I kept thinking about, like, I'm living a lie, you know, things like that. Anyway, gosh, there's so many food memories. If you ask me this tomorrow, it'll change. I would think, you know, there's a couple. I mean, the first time I watched my eldest, who's now a junior in high school, but I think feeding him solid food for the first time was just a miracle. There's so much. I would say also too, like going back to gyros, that was like my dad's special. Like on paydays, we would go in suburban Phoenix, Arizona. to this amazing like Greek restaurant owned by the cutest Greek family. And that was just such a happy memory of like going there. Then we'd go pick out stickers and then we'd go swimming. It was just such a, and then blast, you know, Culture Club, Madonna, Duran Duran. I just have all these, I'm a total 80s baby. And that was just joyful. I associate Euro sandwiches with sunshine and swimming, things like that. Waiting 30 minutes before swimming and things like that. That would be a very hot mess if I did not. So, yeah.
On a different angle, what is the spookiest nature fact that you've discovered?
Ooh, gosh, that's such a good one. You know, it's not really a fact, but I think it was a surprise for me because I did not do reading about it. But just actually, this happened in 2024. Has anybody been in cenotes? Cenotes, yeah, like the underwater caves in usually in Mexico. There's some in Vietnam. I had never been in one before, and I was there with a dear friend, a dear childhood friend. And I didn't realize, no, and nobody, you know, gave me a heads up. I just was like, oh, this is crystal clear water, you know, la, la, la. I swam off a little bit away from our group and, you know, just as exploring the wonderful crystal clear water. And I had my goggles on and a flashlight. And I did the mistake of, like, pointing it towards the darkness. There was just a whole lot of animals down there that were all ghostly white and just, like, Just like they were almost like saying, shh, don't say a thing and we won't harm you, you know. So I just was like, peace out, I'm out of here, you know. When you're that far deep underground and in a cave and you come across animals that you, in the dark, and they're ghastly white, that
yeah,
was...
No, I've seen The Descent.
What's
like,
that?
There's like a cave movie.
Yeah,
about
yeah. I mean, it was just, and I love the water, but that I was definitely not prepared for that. One had whiskers, and one was really long, so I have no idea. And our guide was not, didn't really speak a whole lot of English, so when I said, there's something down there, he just smiled and nodded, you know, so... To this day, that's a mystery. So one of these days, I'll have to go to the library and look that up and see what was going on. But I know what I saw, and there was at least like 9 things down there. Yeah. So.
That does sound spooky.
You asked me. I told you I'm such a nerd.
Whoever.
So
that was a good answer. So you mentioned traveling for that, and I mentioned in the intro because I had seen it on the gram that you went to Greenland this summer.
Yes.
I don't know how much you can talk about that, but I would just
I think my belief is that you
didn't know where you were going.
Yes. Yeah. So that was an incredible situation. Just one of these, you know. I mean, I remember emptying the dishwasher. That's my normal life, you know, and getting this kind of this email, cold email. I had never met these people before. This is this wonderful film crew. In Maine, based in Maine, saying, we picked you for a special project. So, you know, that doesn't sound like the most up-and-up invitation. And then reading further, it still didn't sound like the most up-and-up. They said, like, we are going to have a dancer, an architect, I can't remember some other people, a sculptor, you're the writer we picked, and we're going to fly you to an undisclosed location. But you need to be able to pack within a week's notice, and it'll be international. Is that okay? And I was like, I actually asked my husband, like, if I say yes to this, am I being trafficked? Like, what is going on? They would not give me any information, but there was something that was like, this seems legit, but also not. Because I had never heard of this. Turns out, Ian Chaney is the director. He knows how I feel about his initial email. I said, you could have just made this a lot more welcoming, you know, for me, instead of pack a bag and we're going to take you to an undisclosed location on the planet. I'm choosing my words carefully because the project hasn't been announced, but the gist of it is that they were selecting 4 artists, scholars around the planet to drop them in locations and where they, and the purpose of not telling us where we were going is so that we wouldn't do any research, and we wouldn't look up anything. And then they filmed us, dropped into this place, being astonished, and like, if we had questions, what are those questions? So the place, I didn't know where I was going until, really until I had my boarding pass. And even then, there was no Wi-Fi, so there was nothing. In July, this past July, I boarded a plane for Greenland, specifically a place called Ilulissat, in the Arctic Circle. And thank goodness I packed a jacket. And that was wild, and it was just a big leap of faith. I did have, you know, my people vet them to make sure I wasn't being trafficked. I was dropped in Greenland for 4 days, magical days to see summer in the Arctic Circle. And, you know, I mean, I'm such a dork. I was crying when you see 500 shades of blue in a glacier. That's not something in my normal Mississippi in July, you know, that I see. So it was just, I mean, I just get reclamped thinking about it. But yeah, Greenland, that, again, that is not my normal life. My normal life is puttering around my garden in Mississippi.
Thank you. Yeah. I was going to say, that's a big leap for Mississippi,
yeah,
in the summer.
Very much.
What was your favorite book as a child or a teen?
Oh, my goodness. You know, they were just field guides, and I don't have one in particular, but I remember, I mean, I had a field guide on rocks of Arizona, and I also had a field guide for shells of Florida. They were always, like, location-based. It's kind of hilarious that I'm an English professor. We didn't really have books in the house. We had medical books, but we just always, my parents were like, you have the library, why do you need to buy it, you know? But I would just always, you know, come home with these giant stack of books and then get ready to send them back. And I think back, I can't remember a single literature book that I ever checked out from ages whatever till, you know, high school. I mean, I think I read Judy Blume. I read Judy Blume. She was interesting, and she had, non-Morana characters in her books, who weren't looking for cake or, you know. So Judy Blume. I want to give a shout out to the wonderful, wonderful Judy Blume. But otherwise, yeah. otherwise, it was, I hear myself saying out loud, and it's totally dorky, but my little bookshelf, the precious, precious collection of field guides to rocks, shells, trees, wildflowers. But I was never bored. I just remember, yeah, like staring, like, look at quartz. I don't know. Look at malachite. I mean, again, like, this is, some of the high school students in here will be like, I feel so sorry for your childhood. But this is, I just don't ever remember being bored. And this was pre-screens. There was just, I had a backyard full of cacti in Arizona. And in Kansas, there was just so many weird trees and turtles. I don't know. That was my internet. I mean, it just was never boring. And if I couldn't be physically outside, there were those field guides to ponder over. And yeah. I'm a dork.
Do you still use paper field guides a lot?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's, I actually don't, I thought I might have one here. I actually don't have one with me. But I'm always trying to like memorize and learn and ingest, you know, Mississippi bird calls and just the colors. It's birding season right now. We have, when red buckeye come out in Mississippi, that's time to put the hummingbird feeders out. So our backyard is just full of hummingbirds. And yeah, spring is in Mississippi already. It's exciting for bird nerds.
There was actually a question asking if you can do the cardinal call.
Oh, no. Somebody here has heard this before then, because that is a very specific question. I have to preface this by saying, I do not, if I do this bird call, you have to promise me to not send an angry email to me later, because they do scare me. What I mean by that is, when I do this bird call, there's always some grumpy bird watcher who sends me an email saying, and it's always like 3 or 4 in the morning, so it's always disturbing. I'm not up, but when I wake up the next day and I see this email, it always alarms me. It's like, this is not the correct bird call according to Audubon, you know. And then they say, the correct bird call is this. So they're bird-splaining me first thing in the morning. But I can say, I don't know what else to tell you except it works, and I have plenty of witnesses. If someone gives me a little too much wine, I'll do it at parties, and cardinals will come to our backyard. So I don't know what to tell those grumpy bird watchers except maybe Audubon got it wrong. I don't know. Okay, so please just don't scare me and freak me out with angry emails. Here it goes. I don't know if this is right, but I know that cardinals like it, or they're either angry, they want to come see what's going on. Okay, here we go. Thank you.
When Margaret Atwood came in 2019, she did a loon call on stage.
She?
So you're an esteemed company here at Literary Arts.
All right, great.
We're gonna make a compilation for the radio show. Writer bird call. Yeah.
Amy Tan will probably have bird calls too. So you should ask her to do a bird call.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And you've talked around this a little bit, but I kind of want to ask directly. You know, we have a lot of young writers and students in the audience.
Yes.
And older hopeful writers in the audience mm-hmm. as well. And you've been teaching for a long time, you've been presenting and you've been writing for a long time. What advice do you want to give the writers and readers in the audience about mm-hmm. writing and reading, or just about being people in this wonderful world?
Yeah, gosh. That's a good question, because oftentimes I talk to just high schoolers or talk to full-grown, fully-fledged adults about writing. To mix it all up, I think it would be kind of a version of the same thing that I would say for everybody, and that is to be your most authentic self on the page, whatever that means for you, being, if you're writing poetry, you know, it's not necessarily autobiography. If you're writing nonfiction, just tell the truth. It may not be super flattering, but be your most authentic self. Life is too short to have, I don't know, pretense or try to be cool. I mean, I just did a dorky bird call for you. Like, there is no... I will also say, the reason why I say be your most authentic self is one thing I'm fond of saying is that, I mean, this book, I don't know, I feel maybe this is like weird to say, but I'm just going to say it. It got rejected. Like, oh, I lost track of how many times it was rejected. I stopped counting at 20. So from different publishing houses, that's kind of a lot, you know, and it was a very humbling moment. As much as I've been, you know, in this writing game for a lot, it's a lot. It was a humbling experience. Now, I definitely was revising. I definitely wasn't saying, like, these idiots, they don't know anything. I had offers, and what I found is that oftentimes the editors or publishers would say, we love the book, but can you make it darker? Like, do you have any addictions? Do you have any trauma you could put in? A creepy uncle? That's a true thing. They asked if I had a creepy uncle. And I was like, because we'll give you the book deal if it's just a little darker. So some of my friends were like, Amy, just do it. And I kept thinking, but the only thing I'm addicted to are school supplies and pretty bars of soap, you know?
So, I don't think that counts as dark.
And I actually I like my uncles, you know? Yeah. I don't want to besmirch my uncles. So I say all of this because I'm not going to lie, I definitely paused. But also I was like, that's not me. And anybody who knows me for like 3 minutes knows that that would just not be me. And, you know, it was admittedly, it's a hard sell to start and end the book in Mississippi. And it's going to be written by an Asian American. And guess what? She's going to have memories of being outside. And also, she wants it to be illustrated, and she was gung-ho on making it illustrated by an Asian American illustrator. You can imagine, yeah. And I have to give a shout out to Fumi Nakamura, my incredible, incredible illustrator. I'm working with her for my next book as well. She's the one who did the incredible illustrations. Actually, can we show the illustrations real quick before we leave?
I just realized the frog has been up there.
I know. The pebble toad is also great, but can we turn to the illustrations? There we go. Yeah. So those are some of my favorites. She just, I don't know, it was like she just read my mind and then some. And that was an homage to the books I was reading in the 70s where they didn't have the fancy, high color photograph. They had illustrations. And sometimes they might have one color, you know. So that's my homage to all the nature books I read growing up as a little kid. That was super important for me. And I just, if I were to put some makeup, some darkness, or some addiction, it just would not be me. And I will tell you, again, I feel like I'm always doing the dishes. I was unloading the dishwasher when I get, and it was like in December of 2020. And I don't know if you guys were like this, and no judgment if you weren't, but my family was still wearing masks outside, like to walk the dog. We were still wearing masks outside. This is December 2020. Imagine what you were doing then. I was, just doing, not really happy with life because the pandemic. I was worried to bits about my parents who I hadn't seen, didn't know when I'd see them. Get this magical call from my Milkweed, my press, to say, Amy, are you sitting down? You're number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list. And I was like, wait, excuse me, what? You would never, as a poet, I think you just never, you don't even dream that big. I'm not putting myself down. You just don't dream that big or think that being your authentic self, anybody would care or find it interesting. And who wants to read about dorky girls and, that kind of thing. And people who have crushes and love 80s pop music and also love the outdoors and also can name many plants and trees. It just speaks for itself. It became contagious. It became like just people wanted to read that. I think if I were to put in darkness or make up some addiction or fabricate a creepy uncle, this book would not have done it. So I would just say to be your most authentic self. And if you do have a creepy uncle or if you do have an addiction or something, like, be real about that too. Bring your most authentic self to the page, because someone somewhere out there also wants to hear your story, and maybe needs to hear your story. And that's what I would say, is to be your most authentic self on the page and in real life as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
For being yourself.
Thank you.
That was Amy Nazuka Matatil at Portland Arts and Lectures on Thursday, April 18th, 2024, in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in downtown Portland. The lineup for the 2024-25 season of Portland Arts and Lectures has just been announced. Learn more at literary-arts.org. And Amy's new book of essays, Bite by Bite, Nourishments and Jamborees, is out on April 30th. This has been Literary Arts The Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. The Archive Project is produced in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We have some great episodes from National Poetry Month and beyond, including last year's lecture from U.S. Poet Laureate Ada Limone. Our executive producer is Andrew Proctor. The show is produced by Matthew Workman for Radio and Podcast, with oversight by Crystal Liguori and Amanda Bullock. Special thanks to Literary Arts Marketing staff Jyoti Roy, Hope Levy, and Laura Rankins, and to the entire Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thank you to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thank you for listening. I'm Amanda Bullock, and this has been another episode of The Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.